Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
My name is Angelo Carasone, better known as Stop Back on Twitter, and primarily I spend my time trying to debunk right-wing lies that permeate our media, and there's, you know, one of the places that we do it is on Bob Carson's show.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Lamar Waldron, the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, those two books, the latter of which will become a movie produced and starring Leonardo DiCaprio in 2013, and you are listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hi, this is David Levitt, your host from SYM Radio. SYM Radio is helping raise awareness to missing persons, parental stranger abductions, and human trafficking through our partners. We also raise awareness that people with disabilities can do whatever they set their mind to through the love of God and Christ. And we're proud to be an affiliate with Carson's Corner, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Jay Ray and Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio and also at SYMradio.com/live.
Hi, this is Keith Bishop, author of Slop, The Wild Boar Nation, and you're listening to Carson's Corner, talk radio seeking solutions for today's and tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, author of Sex, Mom, and God. You're listening to Carson's Corner, a show I enjoy. I hope you enjoy it too. I encourage you to listen.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Carson's Corner here on Blog Talk Radio and in conjunction with thecommonsprojectnetwork.com. My name is Bob Carson. I'm pleased to be with you here this evening, this Monday evening. And if you want to give me a call, you can at 347-326-9749. That is 347-326-9749. We also have the chat room open for you as well. If you want to chime in there, that's fine. You can give me any questions, comments, or concerns in the chat room or on the phone line. It doesn't make a difference here on Carson's Corner. This is an independent, progressive radio show. No filters. There's no real constraints here. And that's the way we love it here on Carson's Corner. Anybody can call in. I don't have a phone screener. As long as you're not trolling me, if you have some valid points, questions, concerns, whatever, that's fine. You can call in, and we encourage you to. So what do we got going on here? It's the same old crap, right? I mean, isn't that what we see from our politicians and from our economic system? It's the same old crap. There's no change. There's no nothing. Everything is just continuing on the same pace. It's really, really depressing. It really is. I'd like to see some statistics, some studies as to mental health in America right now because of the economy, because of the fundamentals of our economy, and people just living paycheck to paycheck. I was doing some research a couple weeks ago for one of my websites, and I found out, and this is not surprising, but you hear about so many statistics, and sometimes you lose track or you forget some important statistics that really show you where we are at as a society. But CNN last year, I think it was June 2013, came out with a statistic that said that 3/4 of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and you've got 80 or 90 million Americans living near poverty. And that is just, so depressing. It really is. And then you couple that with income and wealth inequality in America, how 1% of the income earners earn 24% of overall income. You look at the income growth under President Obama last year, 95% of the income growth went to the top 1% of income earners in America. And you could, go, the remaining 5% was distributed out in accordance with, how much you make each year, with basically, a majority of Americans getting nothing. And you could look at, the top 10% of income earners earning, a disproportionate amount of income. And it's just all so depressing. It really is. And you look at what's going to happen tomorrow with President Obama's State of the Union address, which I'm not going to watch. I don't have a television. I may listen to it on Sirius, but, it makes no difference, because President Obama, as we've been saying, and others have been saying, Paul Street and others, has been talking about income inequality for a long time. He ran against income inequality in 2008, right? And, you can even go back to the previous Democratic president, Bill Clinton, with his New Covenant speech, right? How, the wealthy have too much power. We have to center the economy around the middle class, all this populist rhetoric. And then he goes from the New Covenant speech to the era of big government is over. It's remarkable. It really is. But this is what we've been saying about our politicians, is that it makes no difference they say. What they say is whatever they have to say to get elected, right? I'm sure, you look at things like the minimum wage. We mentioned that a vast majority of Americans support raising the minimum wage, okay? I think President Obama is pushing for something like $9 or $10 an hour. But, overwhelmingly, a majority of Americans support raising the minimum wage. Now, has Congress really acted on trying to raise the minimum wage? Has there been any effort whatsoever? No, of course not. Instead, what Congress is doing is, and again, you got to keep your eye on what our elected officials are doing. They're pushing agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would, they're pushing a fast track on this piece of legislation, which would obviously accelerate income inequality, incentivize companies to ship jobs overseas, give corporations, international corporations, nation status, allowing them to sue local governments that pass laws that interfere with their profits. Just the acceleration of free trade, which we know has been an absolute disaster over the past 20 years. But yet, this is where really our Congress is at, because as we've been saying, and many people on the Commons Project Network have been saying, is that Congress is under control by special interests, by elite interests that have more ways than one to enact their agenda. And they could care less about you and I. This is just an absolute reality. If you poll people, if you poll a bunch of, you know, average Americans, people like myself, because I would probably put myself in the average American camp. I make an average amount of money, which is very low considering the state that I live in. I make about, I'm not ashamed to say it, I'm proud of it, I make about $25,000 a year, which is really pathetic, but that's, as far as I know, the average income of Americans is $25,000. If you poll a person like myself, who is a worker, and you ask them what they want done by our Congress, the laws that they want passed, and so on and so forth, you'll see that it almost never gets passed by our Congress. On the other hand, if you look at the business interests of America, if you talk to the 1% of income earners who have experienced all of the income growth and who have essentially all the power in our society, you'll see legislation that these individuals want passed more frequently passed by our Congress, which, by the way, half of our Congress is comprised of millionaires, and the other half of our Congress are rapidly approaching that status. So, you know, you could sort of see that President Obama and the Democrats have accelerated income inequality. So, you know, the corporate media is, you know, they're highlighting President Obama's speech, and they're you know, giving you this very short-sighted analysis, not encouraging, you know, structural analysis of our system and whatnot. And they want you to focus on what President Obama is going to say and this and that. But in actuality, it's completely meaningless, because nothing is going to get enacted that reverses income inequality. Nothing is going to get enacted by our politicians that take away power from the business sector. You know, the various different corporate sectors within our country. And so I just find it so hypocritical. And this is what really gets me angry, is that, you know, President Obama has the nerve to talk about income inequality when his administration, you know, for the last 4 years has done nothing but, I would argue, promote income inequality. And this is why I stopped supporting this guy in 2010. It was 2010 with the extension of the Bush tax cuts, which President Obama campaigned against. President Obama frequently lashed out against the Bush tax cuts. And he extends the Bush tax cuts in 2010, right around the same time that he froze the pay of federal workers. Now, federal workers, I believe, have gotten a somewhat of a pay increase. I believe a very, very small pay increase, something like 1% of their salaries. It was passed recently, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, the freezing of pay of federal workers hurts our economy. And we know that federal workers have been under attack, really, over the last 5 or 6 years, and will continue to be under attack. But he freezes the pay of federal workers on the notion that, you know, it's an increase in spending, but yet he extended the Bush tax cuts in 2010, which, you know, cost our government tens of billions of dollars. In fact, the Bush tax cuts, if you go back to 2001 and 2003, have cost this country trillions of dollars. And it's just a simple measure like that, a simple act like that, which was perpetrated by our president, that accelerates income inequality right there. You know, and then you could look at all those other initiatives after that, the creating of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, which obviously didn't get to enact their recommendations because there wasn't an agreement among the Simpson and Bowles Commission. But the by and large, the gist of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, it was comprised of people that were hostile towards Social Security. You know, you can read all of Alan Simpson's comments about Social Security. The Simpson-Bowles Commission really was the first attempt to create a model for austerity, which it did. It created a model for austerity. And now, after the Simpson-Bowles Commission, you've got these gangs of six or gangs of however many senators looking to cut from the federal budget. And we all know that cutting from the federal budget is not a recipe for growth. It's a recipe for accelerating income inequality. And, you know, I've been victimized by this, and chances are you have as well. You can't cut your way to prosperity, but ever since President Obama really passed the 2010 mark, we've done really nothing but cut and cut and cut, and it's hurt our economy. There's no question about that. I mean, you could look at record-setting defense budgets President Obama has signed. You could look at something like our spending on defense in general, where, as Tom Hartman notes, 50 cents of every tax dollar that you spend goes to the defense industry. All of this promotes income inequality. President Obama, his view on corporate taxes, where he wants to lower the corporate tax rate, just a whole host of issues, unfortunately, that this man really believes, and it's hurt our country. It really has. And so, just disregard this. Just completely disregard this. And you should disregard this president, because what is going to happen over the next couple of years? Let's play the analyst game here and look at the political landscape over the next 2 years, because you and I know what needs to be done. We know that we need to change the fundamentals of our economy drastically, if not, alter capitalism significantly. And there are some people out there that say that we should abolish capitalism. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know. I suggest a few things, but you know what? Some of the things that I suggest may not even work either, because of the nature of the beast, I know what it was like. I've studied economic history to say reasonably when America was at a better point and when America was a more stable country, and if we didn't have the problems that we're having now, we didn't have the debt that we have now. I'm talking about consumer debt, which makes you submit to employment. And I know certain fundamentals and certain principles that if you follow them, then you'll reverse the trends that we've seen over the last 30 plus years. But that doesn't guarantee that it could come back or could not come back. But we know that that's what has to be done. We need to have a real political revolution, a real revolution of thought, where we get rid of certain assumptions that we have. But if you look over the next 2 years, what's going to happen is the rest of this year is finished. The rest of President Obama's term is finished. President Obama had an opportunity to enact real change, to change the fundamentals of our economy during the first couple of years of his administration. He did not. He started bargaining. He started deal making right away, okay, and so he's basically a lame duck president. You've got the Republican Party that I've been saying this over and over again is essentially moving towards fascism. I do consider the Republican Party a semi-fascist party. We can go down the line issue after issue on the economic front, and it's absolutely scary. Just how fanatical and just how drunk with power, with corporate power, these individuals are. And you have so that's where the Republican Party is at. But as I said, the next couple of years for President Obama, he's not going to be able to get anything done. Not that, you know, in terms of making the economy less, coercive to you and I. He may be able to pass immigration reform, whatever, but that's it. It's done. That's it. The Congress can't even extend unemployment benefits right now. And then 2016 is going to roll along, and who are we going to have on the Democratic side? Hillary Clinton, who has a love affair with Wall Street, okay, is being funded by, you know, the same interests that would fund her opponent, likely Governor Christie, okay? And then from there, it's you're going to basically have two political candidates, both under the control of big business in America. And then it comes down to, as Karl Marx said, what candidate least oppresses you? And so that's what we're going to have over the next, you know, couple of years. Nobody knew was going to come on the horizon. It's not going to happen. And so that's going to be our political choice in the next couple of years. And so obviously nothing is going to change. It's going to get worse and worse and worse until, as Tom Hartman points out, we have another crash in America, the crash of 2016. And this, I think, is a likely outcome that could possibly result in some change. You know, I mean, Tom Hartman lays this out in his book on why we're going to crash. There's numerous reasons why we're going to crash. And it's not, you know, the scary thing is that it's not necessarily up to us. I mean, you know, right now, as a result of globalization, the global financial market, countries like China and other countries in that region of the world, and countries in the Eurozone, which there are some countries that are struggling immensely right now under austerity, and still, any one of these countries could collapse. China's economy, by certain accounts, is slowing down, and that's going to have an effect on us, and that's where the crash could begin. So it's not even necessarily that the crash could begin here in the United States as it did in 2008 and as it did in 1929. It could begin anywhere else in the world, and that's really scary. It really is. And that, from there, if we have another crash and we have the right person at the right time and the right political makeup at that time, then we can really enact change. Then we can enact the change that I want and you want, change that's going to essentially handicap the dangerous sectors of our economy. And then we could start to make some progress. We could start to, undo the damage that has been done to us. But that's not going to happen right now. That's not going to happen at all. And so, that's why a lot of people are just disengaged. They're completely disengaged, and they're rejecting the two-party system in America. They're rejecting essentially both major political parties. And that's where I'm at. The one thing that gives me solace, though, the one thing that gives me a little hope, is that ultimately the demographics are on our side. And, the young individuals, millennials out there, tend to be progressive in their idea of the role of government. They want government to offer services on behalf of the American people, that they don't believe in this, libertarian framework of liberty and freedom and these terms that have been perverted by, the special interests of America. They're like you and I, okay? And there's just more of us than there are of them. You look at the Tea Party, you look at the Fox News crowd. And fortunately, these people are dying off. Their ignorance is having, you know, every year and every presidential election, it's having a lesser effect on our discourse and on our policies. But make no mistake about it, they are still a million times more powerful than we are. And I basically conflate them with the business interests of America. You know, the Tea Party, the Fox News crowd, the Republican Party, okay, they're aligned with big business on just about every core issue out there, which is why we've enacted their agenda over the past 4 or 5 years. As I said, you know, they have the power to nullify elections. And that's what has happened in America, is that we've seen a nullification of elections. The Tea Party has had nullification rallies all across America, and they can do that. And corporate America can nullify laws right now, and they've done that. And that's because we're at where we're at right now. But you know, that's what gives me hope, is that there is a bit of an uprising going across the country. We're starting to see some awakening, but you know what? It's not enough. It really isn't. We're nowhere near where we need to be, and that's only going to happen once we have a crash, once we have another crash. Because keep in mind, you know, when we had the crash of 1929, the fundamentals of the economy were very similar to what they are now. Okay, you had 1% of the income earners earning 24% of the overall income, you know, depending upon what estimate you look at. But this is all backed up by Robert Reich and other economists who have looked at the similarities between the economy, you know, in the lead up to the Great Depression and the economy in the lead up to the Great Recession. And now you have a great consolidation of wealth in America, where so many millions of Americans have no wealth. And as I stated earlier, you've got three-fourths of the working population living paycheck to paycheck. You have a financial sector that is out of control, okay? I'm not an expert on the causes of the 1929 crash, but it was as a result of speculation that occurred in Miami after the huge tax cut that was given by Andrew Mellon, the Treasury Secretary under Warren Harding. And that enabled the financial interests to gamble and buy up land in the Florida area. Then you had the hurricane, I think, of 1926. Thousands of people died, and these assets, the land became liability. And, one thing led to another, and boom, you have a 1929 crash that, was much worse than the Great Recession. But another thing that Tom Hartman points out is that the people that experienced that crash, by the time the 2008 crash rolled along, they were gone. They were dead. And so it's called the Great Forgetting, where over 80 years or so, we float in between crashes, okay? And when the last person who remembered the crash dies, we're doomed to repeat it. And that's true with anything. It's not just with economic crashes. I mean, you know, look at Holocaust survivors, and you know, once Holocaust survivors die and nobody remembers, per se, the Holocaust and the evils of Nazi Germany, are we more likely to repeat it after that? I mean, I think that's an extreme example, but you get what I'm saying. You know, I mean, you look at the Iraq War, okay? You know, that was a complete debacle. We all agree on that. But you know what? There's a really, really good chance that we can repeat it, you know, in time, because Americans will forget. Even if the last American who remembers the Iraq War didn't die off, still we're doomed to repeat the same failures, just like we did, you know, after Vietnam and so on and so forth, because, you know, Americans have a very short attention span. There's just no question about that. But, you know, that's what happened. And after the Great Depression, you know, I think you had Herbert Hoover after the Great Depression, and, you know, this is a guy who was apathetic to the poor. He was a businessman, of course, essentially a fascist of his day, and wanted to let the economy settle on its own, didn't want to allow government to regulate and change the way businesses can operate in America, and he left it, and nothing happened. And then I think it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt that eventually took office, and then, you know, history is history. History shows, you know, what he was able to do and the reforms that he was able to enact, making government the last employer of last resort, having successful government programs that are anti-poverty programs and help people work and help the economy and help us have some you know, portion, some sliver of a social safety net in America. You know, it could have been worse, you know, if we didn't have FDR after the Great Depression, if we had someone like, you know, one of these nut job Tea Party people or fill in the blank, who knows what would have happened to this country after the Great Depression. You know, and after the 2008 collapse, you and I thought that we had the right person in President Obama, but then it became apparent that President Obama is nothing more than another politician, and he wasn't there to change the fundamentals of the economy, and he's not cut from the same cloth. Even though FDR came from a wealthy family, he was not cut from the same cloth as FDR in terms of output. And that's what's you know, that's where we're at. So nothing has changed over the past, you know, 6 years since President Obama has been in office. Nothing has changed. In fact, again, the fundamentals of the economy, the move towards fascism, has, if anything, accelerated. The financial sector is bigger. It's much bigger than when President Obama took office, in spite of tepid regulation. Okay. The rich have completely recovered and have made gains since the Great Recession. The rate of unionization still is the same, okay? And there's no talk about bringing back unions in the workforce. In fact, I'm telling you, pretty soon in America, you can get arrested. You'll be put in jail to even discuss unions in America, because that's how much towards fascism we're moving. And in fact, I'm sure in some, you know, places of employment, you can get fired for merely bringing up the idea of creating a union. You certainly can, and it's unfortunate. We've accelerated free trade, or we're on the track to accelerate free trade, which gives away our economic sovereignty over to multinational corporations and further erodes our manufacturing base here in America, which has dwindled to under 10% of our economy, where it used to be, you know, right around the time of Reagan, 25 to 33% of the economy. Our tax code has been highly regressive, even though President Obama has raised taxes slightly on the very wealthy last year to very, very low levels. Still, it's politically unobtainable to go back to the prior to Reagan rates to reverse, repeal the Reagan tax cuts. That's even unspeakable to tax billionaires out of existence. Corporate taxes have remained the same. In fact, you know, these same corporations are bleeding our government dry, using our commons, writing the tax code. shipping jobs overseas, hoarding cash overseas, which is another sign that the great crash may be coming. And still, we haven't moved on corporate taxes in America. I mean, I could just you understand the point here. You get where I'm going here. You understand that we're going down the same path. It's getting worse in this country. It really is. And along these lines, and this is all connected to what we're discussing here today, is net neutrality. You know, this is another example of corporations gouging us and corporations controlling our lives and controlling our freedoms. When, you know, you had the recent ruling by, what is it, the District Court of Washington, D.C., the appellate court, which I believe a majority were Democrats that voted against net neutrality. And so now corporations are going to be able to bundle internet services like cable TV, all right? You're now, because the internet belongs to us, the government invested in the infrastructure to create the internet. It's government spending, R&D spending, our money that created the internet, and now corporations own it. And corporations now are going to create a tiered internet system where you're going to have to pay more for internet service because they want to make more money. That's why. They want more control over your life. They want to privatize everything. These corporations, if they could, they'd privatize your organs. They'd privatize the air. They just privatize everything because they don't give a shit about your life. Your life means nothing to them. As Chris Hedges said, humans have no longer any intrinsic value to corporations. And that's absolutely true. Humans have no longer any intrinsic value to corporations. That wasn't always the case, but that's the case now. You don't believe me? Well, you know, just look at what's happening. Open up your eyes. And so, this is, you're going to spend more out of your own pocket for internet usage. I went to go get my taxes done today, and I pay about a 10% tax rate, which for me it hurts me. It does, but now the same company that I've used for years, increasing their fees now. So when I go do my taxes, I'm spending 25% of my return on the fees. There's just a fee everywhere, a bank fee, a check fee, a this fee, a that fee. And you can look at that on every industry that you see. You know, you look at the telecommunication companies like Verizon and so on and so forth. The fees that they attach to their customers, this fee, that fee, that fee, this fee, this fee. You go to a bank, it's this fee. You get a process. You know, but before you know it, you spend, you know, a majority of your paycheck each week on goddamn fees from these corporations. And still, these corporations, Bob, just go to another bank. Just go to another. Where? What other bank is there? What do I got? Two or three other banks to choose from that have the same business model? What do I do? If I want to go with another cell phone provider, I have to go with another company that's going to lock me into a contract and is trying to compete like Verizon using their model. I mean, just give me a break here. You know, we've monopolized our economy to where consumers don't have any choice anymore. You know, look at healthcare. I mean, just look at every industry. And we're spending more and more and more of our paycheck, and it's going to corporations where they're getting richer and richer and richer, and they're in turn screwing us over with their lobbying, with just, you know, fill in the blank. So we have to wage war on these corporations. We have to contain them. We have to contain the elite business interests of America that have been containing us for 30 plus years to the point where, you know, I'm practically out in the street, man. And I know I'm not alone. I mean, that's what gives me solace too, is that, you know, I'm not the exception. I'm the norm in our society. And that's what we got to do. But, you know, we can't even, I mean, you can't even have this discussion anymore. You know, the politicians like President Obama and other, they'll talk about income inequality. And, you know, again, it makes for good populist sounding rhetoric. But they can't even begin to enact policies that would give the power back to the people. They can't. It's not even close. It really isn't. And so that's why I'm telling you folks, and I've been saying this and I'll say this as long as I have air in my lungs, we are moving towards fascism in America. We are moving towards a complete corporate state. And fascism normally required the violent overthrow of government, but what we're seeing now is not a violent overthrow of government, an overthrowing of government by money, by organized power. It doesn't have to be through, you know, force. It's, you know, this may be a different type of force, but we are moving towards fascism here. And I'll give you examples. I mean, Ralph Nader has written extensively about this over the years. And he talks about the countervailing institutions of America. Labor unions. As I mentioned, labor unions are non-existent in America. Okay, in America, it's practically illegal to join a union. All right, you can't do it. It's impossible. Unions are being eradicated. And in the public sector, unions are being eradicated as well. The fascist Supreme Court, I believe, is pretty soon going to rule on the constitutionality of public sector unions. And once that's stripped, which it will be because we have a fascist corporate Supreme Court, you know, then it's, we're going to have teachers working for $7 an hour. You know, you're going to go to college and you're going to get a master's degree, and you're going to work for $10 an hour. And then you know, our education system will be further privatized and so on. You look at the regulatory agencies. I mean, look at how incapacitated regulatory agencies have become, you know, over the last 30-plus years. I remember during the Bush administration, and this was laid out in the documentary Inside Job, by Charles Ferguson, how during the lead up to the collapse of 2008, the Security Exchange Commission was withered down to a staff of one. I mean, this is, you know, you have one person looking after Wall Street. You have funds to these regulatory agencies being cut. You have lobbyists from the industries going to work for these regulatory agencies. And, you know, you remember last week and last week's show. You've got Julius Genachowski, the former chairman of the FCC. Now, where is he working now? Was he working for Carlyle Group, one of these corporate groups, right? You know, you've got David Petraeus working for a Wall Street hedge fund speculator firm. And Andrew Craig brought up the point that this is part of the brotherhood. This is part of how the elites take care of each other at all of our expense. You know, you know, just look, pick an agency, and it's just riddled with lobbyists and, you know, individuals that are not the cop on the beat. They are, you know, the corporate flunky. Look at consumer agencies, consumer groups, almost out of existence in America. Okay, no power. Yet the political action committees in Washington, D.C., continue to swell, you know, over 10,000. How many lobbyists? I mean, it's, you know, it's just unbelievable. And, you know, going back to regulatory agencies, you can look at the National Labor Relations Board, almost out of existence now, you know, ineffective, unable to govern 80 million workers. The Republican Party, if they had the opportunity, would abolish the National Labor Relations Board. They would. A majority of these fascists would favor abolishing the National Labor Relations Board. Is that not a sign of where we're at in America? Is that not a sign that corporations have essential power dominion and control over everything. The minimum wage, you know, I mentioned earlier that a majority of Americans support raising the minimum wage. Well, you know what? In actuality, if you look at the politics of America, the Congress would probably get more votes to abolish the minimum wage. The fascist Tea Party, the fascist Republican Party, would favor abolishing the minimum wage, let alone increasing the minimum wage, because libertarianism is at the root of our economic policies. It's at the root of political thought in America. And so we're closer to a libertarian paradise than we are to raising the minimum wage here. You know, what shows you something? You know, you've got the appointment of financial managers, right? We're seeing this in Michigan, where you have a corporate lawyer and a corporate mayor of Detroit and other towns, cities, I believe, in Michigan, that are appointed by the governor, Rick Snyder, to circumvent elections and to, you know, sell off company or city assets and to, you know, strip workers the right to collect a bargain. Again, this is all done bypassing the democratic process in Detroit and other cities in Michigan. This is private interests controlling the government. I mean, really. And then the people of Michigan, they voted last year to repeal this financial manager's law, and what is it? Does it make a difference? No. Governor puts it right back in place. And so now you have Detroit, once the epicenter of American manufacturing, just completely obliterated. It's depressing. But that's a sign of where we're at right now, where, you know, the pension holders, the workers, doesn't make a difference. Their interests count as nothing. They have no intrinsic value to corporations. Their lives have no intrinsic value to the very wealthy. And that's all of us. It really is. But, you know, it's just one more example of how we're moving towards fascism. This TPP, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, not even being debated, right? It's going to be put on fast track by our elected officials in closed doors, in quiet rooms. And President Obama is pushing for this, has been. This Chamber of Commerce negotiated, you know, corporate giveaway behind closed doors. It's you know, it gives nations the power it gives corporations the power of being a nation. I mean, it's unbelievable. It really is. This after the first round of free trade agreements has decimated, in part, our manufacturing base in America. Boom. I mean, you know, it's really unbelievable. It really is. But, you know, we have to wake up. We really do, because this is where we're headed. And all of these things that we like in America, right? All of these areas of our economy that serve us well. Police departments, right? Socialism, that's socialism 101. You pay taxes. You don't pay taxes, you're a poor person. You're a rich person. You can get the police to come to your house. You can get the police to respond to you on the side of the road. You're sick, and you get that service from the government. Public roads, you get to go on the public roads regardless of your ability to pay taxes, regardless of your, you drive the same public roads, and these roads are theoretically supposed to be serviced so that you can continue to use them. You know, we have a military that's supposed to be protecting us, right? Military can be argued as a socialist institution, protecting every single one of us, you know, regardless of income, regardless of political power. You know, whole host of other programs that exist that really, to a certain extent, make us a socialist country. And again, these services are widely approved by the American people, but yet they're under attack. They're under attack by privatization, private special interests. And that's just going to consolidate more power. That really is. But I'm going to take a brief time out. We'll be right back here on Carson's Corner in conjunction with the CommonsProjectNetwork.com.
Hi there. This is Justin Ray Harvey of JRA Radio and the co-host of Carson's Corner with Bob Carson. We have an announcement. We are no longer affiliated with Underground Progressive Radio 5:30 a.m. Even though we've had a critical change in the programming, our programming will remain the same. Times are subject to change, so just sit back and enjoy the program as you normally would. The only change is we've grown bigger and better, and like I said, we no longer support or advertise Underground Progressive Radio 5:30 a.m. in any way. Thank you, and show some respect.
This is Lamar Waldron, the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, those two books, the latter of which will become a movie produced and starring Leonardo DiCaprio in 2013. And you are listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vultures Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, we're back here on Carson's Corner in conjunction with the CommonsProjectNetwork.com. My name is Bob Carson. We've got 8 minutes to go in tonight's program. And I just want to tell you that on Netflix, you know that I don't have a television. I just have an internet connection for the time being. And I have Netflix, which is a very, very good service that I enjoy immensely. And they've got this new documentary that came out against about Mitt Romney. It's called Mitt. You know, I mean, we all got the, you know, we kind of figured out what type of guy this is, looking at his business dealings and looking at his just, you know, complete arrogance and contempt for poor people in America, contempt for workers, you know, dismissing 47% of Americans as, you know, takers who can't take responsibility for themselves and consider themselves victims. I mean, this is, you know, reflective of what we see from the elites in our society. So I don't think Mitt Romney, when he espoused this view, was really outside of the mainstream. I think that's where we're at in America. But it gave a behind-the-scenes look at the Romney family, and, you know, through two presidential elections, a 2008 election in which Mitt Romney lost to John McCain, and the 2012 elections, and of course, you know, he was equally repulsive, I thought, in both of them. Not, I mean, you know, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't, you know, it's not like he was, you know, it was like watching The Help or something like that. But you know, one thing that I want to mention is that he was talking, I think, to his family or something like that, preparing for one of his debates, and he was talking about the issue of taxes and how he knows the guy from Papa John's, who's, of course, a big right-wing individual, a big libertarian objectivist. And he was saying how the CEO of Papa John's told him that, you know, when all is said and done, and I remind you, this is a guy who has a huge house, something like a 13-bedroom house with a moat in his yard. I mean, just, you know, more than any person could possibly ask for You know, we can talk about how he achieved that and what led to him obtaining just such a massive amount of wealth for himself. But you know, he was saying that, you know, when all is said and done, I have to pay 65% of what I make to the government. And you know, if I saw today's business landscape and if I saw today's tax rates, I wouldn't even start my business. And you know, I thought to myself, you know, this is a realistic attitude that business owners and the elites have in our society, that we have such a hostile climate to business. And you see this one oligarch, this one, I forget the guy's name, who compared the treatment of the 1%, the very wealthy, to the Jews in Nazi Germany, and saying how, you know, how horrible these people are treated, and that there is an underlying, you know, current in America that could lead to what we saw in Nazi Germany and everything. And you know, it's funny to me, because first of all, if you look at the tax code itself, okay, that businessman, okay, that hedge fund speculator, that fill in your blank, has a much greater say in writing the tax code than you and I do. Okay, these individuals and their interests are reinforced by groups like the Chamber of Commerce, other corporate groups that literally write the United States tax code. And you know, if you're documentaries that's on Netflix, I believe it's called "We're Not Broke," mentions that the United States tax code is over 70,000 pages. And it's 70,000 pages of, you know, that are written for and by corporations, okay? So these people are by and large writing our tax code. Bain Capital has a tremendous say in how our tax code is written. In fact, you can go back to 2006 when they successfully lobbied against an attempt to, I believe it was 2006, to raise the capital gains tax rate. Okay, a tax rate that allows someone like Mitt Romney or Warren Buffett or someone who makes their money in the stock market to pay a lower effective tax rate than a janitor or fill in the blank, which is fundamentally unfair. And then, you know, secondly, nobody makes decisions about starting businesses based on the tax rate. And the reason why we know this is because if you look at the tax rate prior to Ronald Reagan. When Reagan came in, the tax rate was 70%. That scumbag lowered it to 28%, right? I'm sorry, I shouldn't call him a scumbag. That individual lowered it to 28%, okay, and then eventually raised it back up. But even 70% was historically low compared to what it was during the years after the Great Depression, when the maximum tax rate was 90%. And that didn't inhibit people from starting businesses, because people start businesses to meet demand. Well, they may not start businesses to meet demand, but they have to meet demand in the marketplace in order for them to continue to be in business. And so a tax rate means nothing, especially when you look at the allowable deductions and loopholes that our 70,000-plus page, you know, tax code allows these individuals to take advantage of. It's just absolutely laughable. But it's one more, you know, way that we have to pity the businessman, pity the billionaire, and make it more palatable, make it more easy business interests to make more money off of our backs. This type of speech should be marginalized. It should be relegated to the fringe of our political discourse. And we should not look at things through the lens of businesses in America, because businesses are about making profits. That's it. They do not care about the general welfare of the American people. and nor do the business owners. Okay, that's it for this week's edition of Carson's Corner. My name is Bob Carson. Like me on Facebook at facebook.com/Carson's Corner 13 and friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/Bob Carson MMA. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.